Willie Anderson, Cullip versus Commonwealth. Mr. Baldessari, would you like to reserve a portion of your 15 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor, 3 minutes.
All right. You have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is Ken Baldessari. I'm with the Public Defender's Office in Halifax County, Virginia. I represent Mr. Cullip on the habitual offender on the moped charge. There were three assignments of error, Your Honors. One, an alleged due process violation. Two, an alleged ex post facto violation. And then third, a sufficiency of the evidence claim. With regard to the due process violation, Your Honors, as the Court can see from the record, the order that was entered in 1987 by Pennsylvania County only indicated motor vehicles. That was the law at the time. The law was not changed to include self-propelled machinery or other equipment until 1990. And so, given the expectations created by that order and by the state of the law at the time, I believe that a liberty interest was created for Mr. Cullip that essentially...
How would the Commonwealth have dealt with that, though? I mean, there's so many, you know, recidivist statutes.
Your Honor...
Would it have to give notice to everyone?
Yes, Your Honor. I think at a bare minimum, notice would have to be given that...
The statute's been changed.
That the statute's been changed.
So everybody who's been declared an habitual offender, every time the statute's amended, you've got to get process all of them, bring them in court and say, oh, and by the way, you can't ride a moped either.
Well,
practically, what do you do?
Well, again, we are dealing with a very finite number of people, Your Honor. Obviously, we're not making new habitual offenders.
What do you mean a very finite number of people? I bet you there are 10,000 habitual offenders in this state.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue, one, that there are only so many, and we do bring them into court initially for the habitual offender adjudication.
Yes.
And if they are if their liberty is going to be put at risk, if they are going to be incarcerated for conduct they have no way of knowing.
Well, they read the statute.
Well, Your Honor, again, if you look at case, you know, I think it's an analogous situation to what we had in Davis versus Commonwealth, where that was a situation where the court said 10 years, you're a habitual offender. That isn't what the statute says, and they said follow the court order.
What is the Commonwealth to do to give them notice?
Simply telling them that this...
How do they find them to tell them? They can't go through DMV.
Make as efforts to mail through their last known mailing address, Your Honor.
That's sufficient notice?
I think
to meet due process concerns?
I think at a bare minimum, yes, that would meet the due process issue here, given that there is an initial adjudication, obviously. And this is just to advise them there is additional conduct that was not prohibited when you came before the court the first time.
Would that satisfy your second assignment of error, your ex post facto?
Yes, Your Honor. I think if there was some sort of knowledge, I think the ex post facto claim rises and falls with the consideration that the legal disability, as the court said in Johnson versus Commonwealth, is integral to the act. And that's why, you know, the defense attorney in Johnson was, is that the court said that the legal disability of a suspension for, you know, driving on a suspended license is different from an habitual offender. So I think we got to win at least one of those.
Does Mr. Culp have any duty to apprise himself as to the current state of the law, particularly one that directly affects him?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think so, because I think it's so unclear. I think the area of the law is, you know, muddled for someone with essentially a limited education who was indigent. I don't think there's necessarily an obligation on him because
so if I'm a habitual offender and I don't possess a great deal of education, there's no duty incumbent upon me to figure out what I can or cannot do. I just do as I was told 22 years ago and assume that that's fine.
Well, Your Honor, I think there is an expectation created by a court's order. If a court is telling you this is what you can and cannot do, this is what you are prohibited from doing, and if you engage in this prohibited act, there is going to be consequences that could result in incarceration. That is, I think, creating the liberty issue. If we look at VTEC versus Jones, Your Honor, that was a situation where they were trying to involuntarily transfer an individual to a mental health hospital. And the court held that if the state grants a prisoner a right or an expectation, that adverse action will not be taken against him except upon the occurrence of specified behavior, then there are due process protections that are owed. Here we have a situation where the court said, you can, you know, if you drive a motor vehicle, you're going to face the possibility of criminal charges being brought against you. Now, the state of the law at the time was that a moped was specifically excluded from the definition of motor vehicle. It wasn't changed to include until we added self-propelled machinery to the law in 1990.
Isn't your argument stronger, though, if that had just recently happened? You had like a court's order that occurred a year ago as opposed to 22 years ago? Where do we draw the line? I mean, when he's 90 and well, it's been 50 years, he still can drive that moped.
I would respectfully say, Your Honor, that there had been no issues with Mr. Cullip in the intervening years. In terms of habitual offender, since the law had changed. So he had never come into the court's grasp, essentially.
Suppose someone's on probation, and one of the terms probation is, always, don't use any illegal drugs. Mm-hmm. And then the legislature says, these are now illegal drugs. Or this is, we're adding to, as they always do then. And so you get caught using that, and your defense is, hey, look, when they put me on probation, this stuff wasn't illegal. Mm-hmm. Is that a good defense?
Yes, Your Honor, because I think the probation officer told you these are the drugs that you cannot use.
Well, no, that's just, well, we're talking about the order. Order says don't use illegal drugs.
Well, I think that goes more into the context of an argument under Miller about where someone with legal authority over you gave a specific. So I think the situation, Your Honor, is that without anything to tell him that he cannot, that he is prohibited from operating the moped, that there is a due process violation here.
And when you say without anything, you are excluding the Code of Virginia from that.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think this court has said we look at the orders.
I know, but you said without anything to tell him. There's always the Code of Virginia, correct?
Well, again, Your Honor, someone who has already been identified as an habitual offender.
The ironic thing of your argument, though, is that anyone who's an habitual offender who gets an order before the law is changed then can drive a moped, but all the rest of the law-abiding population, as soon as that law was changed in 1990, cannot and is presumed to be aware of the law.
Law-abiding?
If you or I went out there and did it, according to your argument, we would be, you know, absolutely convictable of it.
Well, sorry, I'm confused by the law-abiding part. If we're law-abiding,
well, if we were an habitual offender,
okay.
But if someone who has been an habitual offender and has an order out there saying you're a habitual offender, you can't drive any motor vehicle, but at the time the order didn't include a moped because the statute changed since then. Mm-hmm. The rest of us, after 1990, can't drive mopeds, but he could.
They were put on notice, Your Honor.
We were put on notice because the statute changed.
Well, presumably, a court, knowing that the law had changed, its orders would reflect that and let the individual being adjudicated as an habitual offender that he cannot operate motor vehicle self-propelled machinery.
But the rest of us don't get a notice when the statute changes. And you see my point that you take your... And this is a question more than a point. If we take your argument to its logical conclusion, the rest of us who aren't habitual offenders mm-hmm. are not recidivists of whatever statute it is. Here it's habitual offender statute. Mm-hmm. We don't need any notice because we're presumed to know the law, and ignorance of the law is no excuse. But if you've got an order from when you were a habitual offender, you can still do all the things that the statute now prohibits.
Well, again, if an individual, if we were still making habitual offenders, Your Honor, it's a situation where we would be adjudicated, and that would indicate, you know, what we could and could not do. They would specify what behaviors we could and could not engage in. They couldn't just pull you or me off the street and say you can't drive a moped for no reason whatsoever.
You have to be adjudicated a habitual offender.
Yes, Your Honor. You have to become part of the identified class.
So if that happens later, because you were law-abiding during the rest of that time, mm-hmm. then you're on notice
yes,
because
sir.
The statute was different. when you were adjudicated a habitual offender?
Well, again, I think we're talking past each other a little bit in the sense that if, let's say this were still the 1990s and suddenly we were becoming, you know, within the grasp of the habitual offender statute, you know, we've engaged in behaviors, not necessarily operating a moped. It's behavior after that. So it's a situation where they would have come before the court or been, you know, determined by DMV because eventually they took the process over and told what they could and couldn't do. Moving to the ex post facto argument, again, like I said, this rises and falls in terms of whether or not the court considers the adjudication as part of the act. I think it should because of the court's decision in Johnson indicating that it was integral to the act itself. It's a situation where that began the process. Only individuals identified as habitual offender are under the purview of this law. And it's essentially, the, you know, the order says you can't drive a motor vehicle. It says nothing about mopeds or self-propelled machinery. And suddenly he is being captured by a subsequent change to the law that has removed the complete defense, which, as we see in Bazell or Stogner, is a violation of the ex post facto clause.
You know, the Commonwealth cites, you know, Lilly versus Commonwealth in dealing with this. How, and that's not in your brief, and of course you have a reply brief, so you didn't have an opportunity to respond. How would you respond to the Commonwealth's argument that Lilly really controls here?
I don't think Lilly controls here, Your Honor, because Lilly was a general attack on the law saying, we've repealed it, why are we still hurting, you know, why are we still going after these folks that have already been made habitual offenders? That's, you know, goes to more rational basis, and the legislature can make its argument, it certainly has a rational basis to say, these people that have been identified, we want to keep them under our thumb, for lack of a better term. So I think it's comparing apples and oranges, essentially. This is a situation where individuals were told what behavior they couldn't engage in, and then suddenly, so if you know, if he had been driving a moped in 1988 or 1989, he would have been violating no law. But because of the change in the law after the fact, it's a situation where that, you know, the retroactive effects of that bring it running afoul of the ex post facto clause.
Just to let you know, you're into your rebuttal time. You can continue or reserve.
I will reserve the rebuttal time.
Ms. Darren, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Father Counsel has only discussed the two constitutional issues raised in his brief, and I'll rely on my brief for the sufficiency issue unless the Court has questions. Turning to the due process argument, what the defendant argued this morning and on brief at page 9 of his brief is that he's entitled to particularized notice of the change in the law in order for his conviction not to violate his due process rights. And we just simply argue that he's wrong on that point. It flies in the face of the law, presumes that citizens know the law and that ignorance of the law is no excuse. And it cuts in the face of the fact that this man was convicted of being an habitual offender. And he was provided with notice based on that adjudication that he is subject to regulation separate and apart from the general population. And it's our position that the statute in effect, 462.357, coupled with the fact that he had notice that he was an habitual offender, he would be treated differently with regard to driving regulations, that those two, and that ignorance of the law is no excuse, that these factors...
It's not in dispute that this gentleman knew he could not drive a motor vehicle.
That's correct.
Who had the duty to see what is a motor vehicle?
He did.
And if he had that duty to determine what is a motor vehicle, I guess you can read the statute. You can read the statute.
That's basically our position. And so what he's saying is that he's entitled to some super notice because of his status as an habitual offender when actually it's the exact opposite, that it's the habitual offender conviction, adjudication, if you will, gives him notice that he's going to be treated differently than that coupled with his obligation to stay abreast, as we all are, to stay abreast of the law. The outcome is that he's not entitled to that kind of particularized notice in the first place, but second of all, that the due process is simply not violated, was not violated in this case, under the circumstances of this case. With regard to the ex post facto change in the law argument, our position is simply that the order that he was under finds him to be an habitual offender within the meaning of the code, and I'm looking at page 202 of the appendix, and that the court does find him to be an habitual offender, and he's directed not to operate a motor vehicle on the highways of the Commonwealth. The ex post facto argument, the trial court found that the added language that, so first of all, I will jump back and say that this area of the statutes change virtually every year. So to say that you could never alter the statute without it becoming ex post facto it defies common sense. So, and I think that's pretty much the basis of his argument. Then we've relied on Saunders, which says that the defendant doesn't have to be advised that the statute has been changed and that it has been tweaked and to include motor vehicles and self-propelled machinery or equipment. That the added language, the language that has been added to the statute has really been a matter of clarification and specification with regard to what types of motorized vehicles are covered. And the confusion comes in to a certain extent because we're talking about the same definitions that cover habitual offender versus a suspended sentence. So we submit that the case law in Lilly, set out in Lilly, and this in the Saunders case, in this court, in the Saunders case, which indicate that there is no ex post facto issue and viable ex post facto issue here. The law was changed in 1990, and the defendant was charged in 2012. So, again, that's our position. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me ask you a little bit about...
darn.
Before you get away from the podium. Miller versus Commonwealth, you know, the good
yes.
faith reliance case.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that and why your view that...
Miller and I think it's Clater is the other case.
Mm-hmm.
Those cases talk about a situation where a defendant is affirmatively told by someone in a position for him, so in the Miller case it was he asked his probation officer whether he could possess a
black powder gun.
And he was told yes, when in fact he was prohibited from possessing such a weapon. He's relying on an absence of information versus an affirmative statement from someone in a position for him to rely on that he would not be violating the law. And we don't have those facts in this case. Our defendant, you know, didn't even testify in this case. So, you know, Clater and Miller are not in his, don't help him for that reason.
On assignment of error three.
The sufficiency issue.
Yes. His license was suspended not revoked? Is that the technical?
Well, I think we go back to the first of all, if you're looking at the habitual offender order, the habitual offender order simply says that he is found to be an habitual offender, and he's directed not to operate a motor vehicle, and he's ordered to surrender his license to operate the motor vehicle. And then the information from the Department of Motor Vehicles says, in addition to that, he's told that on thus and such a date, he could go back, he could petition the court for reinstatement of his license. And then if the court decided that he was entitled to that, he would have to go to DMV and get a new license. So if you look at the language of the order and then you look at the Thomas case, where basically the defendant is arguing that the order didn't contain the word revocation, and so he wins based on the fact that the order didn't contain the word revocation, that it was more, and his argument today is that this is more like a suspension than a revocation. Well, clearly, when you look at the order coupled with the order of suspension from DMV, this is clearly a revocation case. And the fact that Deputy Hudson testified that that when he ran the defendant's record, that the defendant came back with his driver's license suspended as HO, or the fact that the Commonwealth stipulated that the defendants that used the word in the stipulation, that they used the word suspended versus revoked, is not controlling. And we on the sufficiency issue, and we rely on the analysis in the Thomas case for that.
I guess in 46.2357A, it speaks of it as being revoked. Mm-hmm. But in 46.2-357C, it talks about while his license, permit, or privilege to drive is suspended or revoked.
Well,
or
and again,
charged
I think
without
that,
driving
that,
without a license.
Yes, and so I think that also supports our position that this, you know, the magic word revoke is not controlling on the sufficiency as a matter of law, that the evidence would be insufficient. You have to look at the order, and you have to look at on page 202 and page 203 about what the defendant was advised. And there's absolutely no way that the order coupled with the information from DMV could be construed in any way being a mere suspension versus a revocation, where he has to reapply, where he's told to surrender your license, it's going to be destroyed, you have to go back to court to get reinstated, and then you got to go to DMV and get a new license. So this is not a suspension case. We ask that the conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Darren. Mr. Baldessari, you have your rebuttal time.
I had a quick question, and I don't mean to be frivolous, but your client was adjudicated a habitual offender in 1987.
Yes, sir.
Does that mean he can drive an electric car, which didn't exist in 1987? I mean, there were no electric motor vehicles in 1987. Can he drive one of these Leafs?
Your Honor, I'd have to look at the definition of motor vehicle off the top
okay.
of my head.
I don't think electric
power.
Cars existed in 1987.
I was about two, so I don't know.
You're a lucky man, let me tell you. I wish that were true for me.
He was probably driving an electric car.
If I can briefly touch on the sufficiency arguments, it was stipulated at trial. The Commonwealth stipulated that his status is suspended as an habitual offender. The Commonwealth cannot come in here today and say that's not the case.
Does it matter, though, given the language in 46.2-357C, that where it says suspended or revoked?
Yes, I do, Your Honor, because in Rose versus Commonwealth, the Supreme Court of Virginia specifically said to sustain a conviction for a habitual offender, they must show that the driving privilege was revoked. It doesn't say revoked or suspended. 46.2-100 gives specific definitions to both revocation and suspension.
Even though in C it says, for the purpose of enforcing this section, in any case in which the accused is charged with driving a motor vehicle or self-propelled machinery equipment while his license, permit, or privilege to drive it is suspended or revoked, for the purpose of enforcing it.
No, I think Rose is controlling over this decision, Your Honor. They used only the term revoke. And I think if we look at the Thomas decision, we see Judge Petty going through great pains about the difference between revoke versus suspension. And I don't think he does that if a suspension is if he could just as easily say it's 6 1/2 dozen in the other. You know, it doesn't matter if it's revoked or suspended. I think because of the fact that it only uses the one term, both terms are, you know, have separate definitions. It's having the court say that they mean the same thing or it doesn't matter gets, I think, into legislating from the bench, essentially. And we're in a situation where we try to ascertain what the legislative intent is, and we have to do that by the words that were used by the legislature in that section. And it used in Section A, revoked, while the revocation determination is in effect. Thank you. We'd ask the court to reverse and dismiss.
Thank you, Mr. Baldessari. We will greet counsel, and then the final case.